my guest is Malcolm Sheridan. Malcolm, how are you doing, sir?
Good, David. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Where are you from?
I am from Melbourne, Australia.
Melbourne, Australia. I've been there. That's a great city.
You've been to Melbourne?
I've been to South Werribee. My sister-in-law's from South Werribee.
Oh, that's right. I do remember you talking.
Yeah, my brother lives in Sydney now.
Yeah, it's a great place. Yeah. Great place.
And you're a speaker. You're a web guy, right? You speak about web development. Actually do some web development in real life.
I do quite a lot of web development. So I'm a ASP.NET MVP. Mm-hmm. I am a ASP insider, as well as being a Telerik insider. And the only work I do is ASP.NET MVC work these days.
Yeah, we were talking earlier about a talk that you put together. This is what you wish, I don't remember the title of it, but it was basically what you wish you knew now. You know now that you wish you knew when you started doing MVC development.
Lessons learned from being burnt. That was the title of my talk.
So are you an MVC guy? You bought into the MVC framework?
Yeah. I mean, I was a webform guy since the beta back in 01 or 2000. I was doing webforms ever since MVC was released. Mm. And then I was very tired of the webforms model. Yeah. And I just thought MVC was a better way of doing things. And I've been doing MVC ever since it was released.
Okay.
So
I bought into that early on as well during the they called it beta. It was like a CTP or something like that.
Yeah.
And I like the cleanness of it.
Yeah.
But like you, like most people, I just kind of learned it as I went. And some things I didn't learn until my third or fourth app.
Yeah.
What are some of the lessons learned?
Some of the lessons learned, so I delivered this talk at Tech Ed Australia in New Zealand, which isn't as big as the US, but it's a big deal for Australians. And it has been a while since I've done this talk, so I'll just point that out before I go any further. I think off the top of my head, there was about 10 lessons. So I started off very early with the easiest ones with error handling. Mm-hmm. So how to set up error handling, different ways of using error handling through filtered attributes, through to using different routes for error handling, how to set up ELMA for error handling.
What's ELMA?
The error logging module, okay, which you can download through NuGet. And that just does basically all the error handling and sending emails for you. So it's a great little tool, free.
Okay, you didn't know about any of that stuff. What were you doing originally?
Just like most people, just writing my own email client, sending emails the hard way, doing like try catches,
okay,
around a lot of actions. And as it turned out, that's not a really good way of doing things. So that was one of the ways I wish I knew when I was first starting MVC. How to set up security in an MVC application. It's a little bit different from a web forms application. We've still got the membership provider and the role provider.
Right.
But how you implement those through like authorize action filters or writing even your own custom action filters differs a little
bit. That's interesting, because is there another way? With web forms, typically you would put security on folders and on files. Were you trying to do that with MVC? Because that doesn't really work at all. Unlike try-catch does work for your error handling.
Yeah.
But because we're not accessing files with our URLs, we're accessing controller methods.
Yeah. I don't think I was ever doing security the wrong way.
Okay.
When I was starting out, but I thought it was a good topic to throw in there, because some people mightn't be aware of it. In web forms you do secure files and folders, and in MVC you secure actions and controllers. Mm-hmm. So people found that was a very good topic to talk about.
Sure.
And another one that we did was handling AJAX exceptions.
Yeah.
So in MVC, AJAX, if you don't handle AJAX exceptions correctly, they will fall silently and you will never ever know why they're failing. So
what's the correct way to handle AJAX exceptions?
The correct way to, well, the way that I thought or found out was best to handle AJAX exceptions was to create a action filter and be able to query the actual return type of the exception. So if the exception was a JSON exception, you can actually return that as part of the message going back to the client.
Okay, so what's that action filter on the server side? Decorate the action with this attribute.
That's right. So you decorate the action with this attribute. You throw an error, gets to your action filter. It says, okay, I need to return this particular message. So what you do is you change the HTTP status going back to the client. So you could. So what we were doing was we were returning 666, the sign of the devil. So back on our client in the JavaScript, we were checking for HTTP status messages of 666, and if it was that, we knew there was an AJAX exception. So we could handle that, display, you know, a nice little message to the browser, and the user was none the wiser. And it was also being logged on the server through Elmer, which is really nice.
Okay.
So that was AJAX exceptions. Multiple form submits. So on my... I need to give you a little bit of background where I work. I work for one of the four banks in Australia. Can't really say what we do because it's all private, but we do some stuff with quantitative analysis. Mm-hmm. So calculating interest rates, calculating cross-sell, like a lot of financial stuff. And we do a lot of C++ work, which is integrated into the website through WCF services, and that sits on a couple of servers, and we've got our front end which talks to the WCF, which talks to the C++, and it's all works very, very nicely.
Okay.
So we had occasions where we had forms with multiple submit buttons. So typically a form's only got one submit button, where it just does like a post or a get, but there are occasions where we need to have one form with one or more submit buttons, just the way we architected the solution.
Okay.
So when you have multiple submit buttons, they're always going to go, or they're always going to post back to the action of the form. Now,
by default they will.
By default they will, yeah. And the way that I can't remember the way that we were doing it initially, but the best way to handle this was to create a custom action filter attribute that derived from the action method selector class. Okay. So the action method selector class basically gets executed before your action filter. So the method that you use is I can't remember the method, but it basically you override one method and it returns a true or false value. So what we were saying was we had two buttons and we put on a particular class, like maybe its ID is save and the other ID is delete. That's a good example.
Okay, that will tell this method which button actually was.
Which button was being clicked, and what you do is you decorate. So this is an action filter attribute.
Okay.
So you decorate your methods that are going to be accepting the save data and one that's going to be accepting the delete data. So what it does is this action filter gets executed, and it says, okay, what was the what's the incoming ID? If it's save, I'm going to redirect you to this action. If it's delete, I'm going to redirect you to this action.
Okay. So is this part of the routing engine?
It's not actually part of the routing engine.
This is after the routing engine kicks in.
Yeah, this is definitely after the routing engine kicks in. But it's at a lower level of an action filter. And it's a nice way of being able to view all the information that's being posted from the form before your action filter gets executed.
Sure. I guess I wasn't aware of that at all. In fact, I would, in situations like that, I think you and I might have done the same thing before we learned of that, which is that we'd have one method and there'd be a case statement in there. Say if that action is to delete.
Yes, actually,
then
call
this other private method. Huh?
Yeah. I think what we were doing initially was we'd have an action, and we'd have two parameters. One was like a string save, a string delete, and it'd go if save is equal to null, then it's delete, and if delete's equal to null, then it's a save.
Yeah, so it's binary, and if it's multiple ones, then you have a case statement there.
Treated
like an enum, but usually it's just a string.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And in this way, we could just.
But your way is much more elegant.
I thought so, yeah. Just trying to keep all the actions clean, lightweight,
sure.
Put all that hard code in behind the scenes, which is really nice.
Very cool, okay. What else?
All right, so routing constraints. So one of the big misconceptions about MVC is how to use routes correctly.
Okay.
Most people in a lot of projects don't actually use routes to their full potential.
Sure.
So one way that we were trying to use routes to the full potential was we had, unfortunately, we've still got a lot of users using Internet Explorer 6 at the bank. That's just an unfortunate thing about working for a bank is it's trying to get them to move is like trying to push an elephant. It just doesn't work.
Right.
So what we were noticing was on the users that were using IE8, everything was working fine. But if a user came in through IE6, we'd get these some Excel errors being generated on the server.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't 100% of the time happening. It was only maybe 20% of the time. So what we did to eradicate all those errors was to set up like routing constraints, but implementing our own custom routing constraints that could check the request headers coming in when the user came to the website, and we could check the user agent to see if it was an IE6 browser coming in.
Something special to that, or send it to us its own controller action?
Yeah, we basically send it off to its own controller action, so it wouldn't throw this particular error. So instead of trying to handle that in the action, moving that code out of the actions and then back into the routing just seemed like a natural thing to do. So that was one thing that we
learned. Are you doing that through code, or are you doing that through, I shouldn't just say code, but are you doing that just as part of in the global ASAX where you're adding routes to it?
Definitely.
Or is there more logic to it?
Well, there's more logic to that, but you need to set up you need to map the routes through the route table, and that's through the global ASX file, and then we've got separate projects for all our routing constraints in there.
Okay.
So another thing we were doing with our routing constraints was setting up particular action methods so they would only be hit by particular HTTP verbs. So we set them up so this particular action, action A, could only be hit by a post, action B would only be hit by like a get, action C would be like a delete.
Or using all the verbs.
Yeah, we were
very
using
restful
all
of you.
Yes, well, we were trying to. And D was like a put or an insert.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what you can do is, this is very, very simple to do in routing,
mm-hmm.
in the route constraints, just by setting up...
You can actually set this up on the inside of your filter methods on your controller, or attributes on your controller actions. And in fact, if you just right-click and say add controller, and you specify
CRUD methods.
You specify CRUD methods. You want to just have it bound to one of your models.
Yeah.
Then it actually does. It has two edit methods in there.
Yeah.
One to show the edit, that's the get.
Yeah.
And one to save the edit, and that's the post.
Yeah.
And so you're just extending that.
Yeah, we're just extending that. So basically you remove that code,
uh-huh.
put it into the routes table. So basically, uh-huh. And it's very, very simple to set up. So basically you say if this request comes in and it's requesting customer/1, you can say that's going to be limited to a get.
Right.
Or if it's just going to be customer/list/insert, you could actually put that off to a procedure or an action that's only inserting a post.
Okay.
So that was pretty cool.
Right. You moved it upstream from where the default is.
Yeah. The one downside of that is when we had new developers coming onto the project, discoverability was quite difficult for people who weren't understanding what we were trying to do. So they would come straight into the controller, try and figure out what was happening, and not realizing all the heavy lifting was being done elsewhere. So
they
were trying to debug things. Things weren't getting, like breakpoints weren't getting hit, and they were saying, I'm really not sure what's going on. So we'd have to go and show them this is what we're doing. And for me, it's a cleaner way of doing things. But there's a downside of doing that sort of code, but it works really, really nicely. All right, routing constraints. Controller action invokers. That was a really, really cool one that we did. So this one, from memory, we did this because basically working for a bank, we've got a lot of business people, and a lot of business people want reports. And they want different types of reports. So they want XLS files, CSV files, XML files, TXT files, and we've even got our own proprietary files, which we can't obviously talk about now.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of trying to write multiple actions to return different action results, what we did was we did that initially, but then we figured out of creating a class which is basically a custom controller action invoker. So that's actually grabbing or intercepting the request before it hits any controller, and seeing, okay, what's this user actually want? So what they want comes in through the URL. So the URL will specify customer/get reports/CSV. That could be a demo URL. So we know that the person wants customer, and the ID could be in the URL, and we know they want a report, and we know what type of report they want. So we can basically just have all this code to say, okay, this person wants a CSV report, go off to this method, get all the data, put it in a CSV file, and just return it. So what we'd do is we'd have one action which was returning multiple reports.
Okay, because logic to get the data was the same every time.
It was the same.
It's just the action result.
Yeah, the content type was being switched by the controller action invoker.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a nice way of having a very, very clean controller with you know, one or two actions.
Mm-hmm.
And all the heavy lifting was done by this controller action invoker class in the background. And that was a nice thing. That was a nice thing. One other thing, it's not really a lesson learned from being burnt, but it was sort of like a tip that I closed off my tech ed talk, and I think this is the thing that really sent my scores over the top, was forms authentication. One thing that most websites we work with has is it's got some sort of customization. So when you log in, it'll say, oh, hi David, you know, the last time you logged in was 1st of July 2011 or something like that. And normally that information is coming back from the database. So one thing that I'm a big advocate of is not using session for anything. I just dislike session state in ASP.NET applications. If I never have to use it again, I'll be a very
happy. There are issues with it. It solves some problems, but it causes some problems.
Causes a lot of problems. So basically, if you don't use the database, typically what you do is, like, for every time an action is called, you go off, fetch that same information back from the database, display it to the user.
Okay.
So what we did was there's a method when you use forms authentication. You can basically override this particular method and stuff a string into this method. And that's actually set inside of the forms authentication cookie that's stored on the client.
Yeah.
So every time the page is loaded, what you can do is just reach into this cookie, pull out this information, and display it to the user. Now, you can store anything in there. It doesn't have to be, you know, something about the user. It can be basically any object that you can turn into a string. But for us, we were displaying the person's name, and I think it was the last time they logged in. So instead of having to go up to the database for each call...
Yeah, or going to session state for each call, you're just reaching into the cookie.
The cookie, displaying it to the user, and that was it. And it was a really simple thing. Now, of course, whenever you use cookies, they get sent up to the server for every request. But for the small amount of data that we were storing in there, it seemed like a really, really good thing to do instead of going off to the database or storing it in session.
Sure.
And that was the last thing I spoke about at TechEd. And everyone loved it. Everyone absolutely loved it.
I think my audience is going to love it as well. And I think you're also this is about show number 200 or so.
Oh, excellent.
I think you're the first Aussie I've had in the show.
Well,
I'm going to have to go back and check that, but I'm pretty sure that's true.
I'm very proud to be the first Australian, David. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, David. I just need to say technology in France. Okay. Technology in France.